Hello, everyone. This is The Game podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer, and we thank you once again for joining us. Despite there being no football, you have stuck with us right here on The Game podcast, and we'll do our very best to keep you informed and entertained. Of course, we are social distancing, so joining me remotely, as ever, it is Gregor Robertson, and today we're joined by Jonathan Northcroft. Before I speak to Jonathan, Gregor, how are you, and at what stage in your push-up challenge you're at?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm up to the grand old number of 43.
Oh.
And everyone's improving, you know. There's like guys in their 60s that have gone from 7 to 12 or something. It's an eclectic bunch, so it's a good idea.
It is a good idea, but you've gone up, what, just 3?
Well, no, because my first one was below that, but I didn't tell you that.
Okay. All right. Just checking. All right. Well, you're doing well. Good on
you. Thanks. Yeah.
Jonathan, I don't know if you're aware, but obviously Gregor has been doing a push-up challenge. It's a daily challenge. So if you wish to join in, I'm sure he'll greatly yeah. receive your membership to this push-up challenge. But how are you keeping, Jonathan?
I'm good, actually. I'm enjoying the wonders of homeschooling, seeing a lot of stuff from my window and not getting out much. But it's fine. It's nice having a bit more family time, missing football, of course. But so get back to me in a few weeks. It's all right at the moment.
Yeah, indeed. Well, what we do, though, have to look forward to in the Sunday Times is you've done a little interview, a little chat with Wayne Rooney.
Yes. So we've got the next Wayne Rooney column coming up at the weekend. He had quite a good idea this week, which was to ask readers to suggest a game or a tournament for him to review, one that he played in. I won't spoil things by telling you which one was chosen, but I spoke to Wayne this morning and some really fascinating stuff.
Oh, okay. We look forward to that. Coming up, we are reviewing some classic Premier League clashes as Match of the Day returns to your screens on Saturday night. And I'll be putting our panel to the test with some football brain teasers. So plenty is to come on this podcast. But first, it's time for this.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Premier League clubs are living in a moral vacuum and players should be first to sacrifice salaries during the coronavirus pandemic. That's what Julian Knight, the chair of the Digital, Culture, Media and Sport Committee, thinks about teams who are taking advantage of the government's furlough scheme to relieve workers. Tottenham, Newcastle, Bournemouth and Norwich have all opted to utilise the scheme, which sees the government fit part of the bill for workers laid off due to the pandemic. Here is what Julian Knight then had to say about wealthy Premier League clubs using this scheme. He said, "It sticks in the throat. This isn't what the scheme is designed for. This exposes the crazy economics in English football and the moral vacuum at its centre." Gregor, people are talking about a moral vacuum then in football. Do you feel that there is an issue here?
Hell yes. I think you don't know where to start. I mean, the obvious place is with the owners and, you know, oligarchs and tax exiles and Gulf states. We've got a very kind of, again, eclectic bunch of owners of Premier League football clubs. Agents taking vast sums out of the game. But I think we also have to say that, look, football is not alone in this. Football's always the first in the crosshairs when it comes, when money's involved. And but we all see the news. We see EasyJet bosses have been paid out $177 million in bonuses, but they've furloughed all their staff. Richard Branson's been in the news quite a lot. He's a billionaire and he's looking for a government bailout for Virgin Atlantic. And even like I started thinking this week, closer to home, my fiance has been furloughed. She works for a fashion house with a turnover probably similar to a club like Everton. Decent profits, and they've completely shut down. This is something that is, you know, there's very few companies and businesses that are escaping it, and all everything's shut down. The business is completely shut down, and so my fiance and all the staff have been furloughed. And really, I'm not sure what the difference is. I understand that footballers are very public faces. They earn huge money, but ultimately they're employees, and it does stick in the throat a little bit when you think that football clubs are furloughing staff, and they're potentially looking at losing some of their money, while footballers haven't come to a decision yet or collectively come to an agreement of what they're going to do. I'm sure it's going to happen, but again, football is not alone in this, and there's a lot of questions about what's going to happen with the money that footballers give up, because if clubs have already furloughed their staff, it's no longer a case of footballers saying we'll give up 20% of our earnings and that'll help everyone stay on the wage bill. It's a very complicated issue, and I think football is always the first thing in the crosshairs in this sort of instance.
It's an interesting point Gregor makes, Jonathan, about the furlough scheme. Obviously, a lot of clubs, as we've already mentioned, have taken the opportunity to use it. But should they be using it already before, say, some of these player wage cuts that have been suggested that should be happening, which could go towards paying some of these non-playing staff members first before then engaging in the furlough scheme?
So I think Greg sets it out quite well, actually, that I think there is a sort of moral vacuum there in football. There's a moral vacuum probably at the heart of business. And as Gregor points out, Richard Branson, EJet, aren't behaving particularly well at this time. The banks aren't behaving particularly well if you look at reluctance to give businesses loans that the government have told them to give. Business as a whole is being shown up at a time like this. It should be different, because the point about football is something more than just a business. That football is telling us it's more than a game, that it means something to people, that it's got a special place in people's lives. Well, it's time it started acting like that. It's time it started thinking that it draws its strength and its power from the communities, from the fans that it represents, from connecting people, and that because of that, it's a responsibility not to just behave like cynical business, because once it starts doing that, then it stops being magical, it stops being a game, it just becomes numbers. We don't want 50,000 people to sit there on a Saturday watching bank accounts come down, but that's the way football's behaving at the moment. And yes, footballers should be taking wage cuts, I do believe that. But I think first and foremost, the owners should be up money. I have little faith in the PFA, I'll be honest, but I do see where they're coming from to an extent on wage cuts, because they're asking, well, what are the owners doing? What are the club accounts saying? Now, you've got Mike Ashley asking Newcastle to use the furlough scheme. Mike Ashley's worth £2 billion. This is where football's got to be careful, because if it's just going to behave like any other business, then it stops being that magical thing. And I hope that people remember how certain clubs and some people have behaved during this time, because the next football restarts and it tries to sell us, or certain clubs, people try and sell us that it's this dream. We've got to remember, acted at this time, and I'd hope that it is borne in mind that those have acted well are credited for it, but those that don't, we kind of see through cynicism a little bit when it comes back.
Like, I absolutely agree. I think the one thing we have to acknowledge is that this government scheme had to be one size fits all, because if you could not imagine. It wouldn't have worked otherwise. You couldn't imagine means testing every business that wanted support at this time. And also, you know, Johnny's absolutely right, but that was the idea about football being magical at the top level of the game. That's a facade now. Those days are over. I think this is illuminating that fact, and we should remember. But I think if we really, if we're being honest with ourselves, I think we know that was a facade. That those days are long gone.
But it's interesting. I mean, Johnny, you mentioned that the bonus that Daniel Levy earned, and this was following the stadium, obviously, with Tottenham moving into their new stadium, which came, obviously, 7 months late. Do you balk in a way at the fact that he accepted that multi-million pound bonus and now puts we now find Tottenham in this situation where they're furloughing their non-playing staff. If you actually look on Twitter, I did look the other day, and there was a couple of tweets that Tottenham sent out, and a lot of responses were simply, pay your staff, pay your staff, pay your staff. I mean, I personally, when I see the amount of money that Daniel Levy has made from a stadium that took so long to build, the fact that he's earned money out of that and hasn't thought, if I just put that back into the club, it might help us a little bit. Just tie us over for a month or two.
You're right, Natalie. I agree. I mean, the staff they're talking about furloughing, a lot of them are going to be pretty low paid. It's not going to save them that much money, as it were. It's going to be £1 million, £2 million or whatever. Which in their scheme of things, in the scheme of Daniel Levy's bonus, I think he has deferred some of it, but in the scheme of how much money he's made and is making at Tottenham Hotspur, because he owns shares as well, it's nothing. And in the scale of the £170 million profits, it's nothing. I've got no problems with, in a way, in another business doing it, because business is business, but football is it pretends to be something different. That's the point. They market it as something different. Spurs, you know, to their team and all that sort of stuff. They market themselves as different. And I don't blame them. The fans want it to be something different. They want Tottenham to be about glory. Football fans want their clubs to represent something different in lives. So it can't behave like this, surely.
Well, it was mentioned obviously about the PFA and their responsibility. Talks are ongoing between themselves and the Premier League and the EFL, but it appears they have hit a bit of a deadlock. The talks were described as calm, but PFA Chief Executive Gordon Taylor is pushing for a joint agreement on wage deferrals, understood to be up to 50% for the highest earners. At the same time, the PFA has advised players in the lower divisions not to sign any requests from their clubs to accept wage cuts before receiving legal advice from the union. The situation may well be different for Premier League clubs. Now, Gregor, as an ex-player, do you trust that the PFA are actually doing the right thing and have their players' best interests at heart in this situation?
The one thing you can always say about the PFA, among many, is that yes, they have the players' interests at heart. That's their fundamental purpose. The other thing that you have to say is that, and I have experience of this, is that the wheels have always turned painfully slowly within the PFA, like in every aspect of its functioning, and this has been no different. So, where you'd hope it would be a proactive union at this moment in time, and have come to some sort of collective agreement earlier than this and quicker than this, it's no surprise to me that it hasn't. I think something will be worked out in the coming days, I'm sure. But it is also worth acknowledging again that this is not straightforward. You know, their members encompass Manchester United and Macclesfield Town, so that there's players there who are on £350,000 a week, and players who are genuinely on £350 a week. So it's not like a standardised one fits all in this instance of collective action, saying everyone's going to take a cut across the board, because it can't be. And then, as Johnny's alluded to, we need to ascertain what the money's... If it's being deferred, then with what purpose? If football clubs, if their owners, their employers, are already taking government funds. So, and if it's being cut, or if there's going to be a fund, then where is that money where's it going to be spent? Who's that going to be to the benefit of? Because I think there should be something. It shouldn't just be the players defer 20% of the wages and they get it back at a later date when football restarts. There should be something now. It might be a much smaller percentage that is creating a fund. It's a hardship fund, essentially. That's the other thing that the PFA is. PFA have vast reserves, and it should be a hardship fund for players, and there's going to be players in the coming months, I'm sure, who need it, who need help, because they might fall out of contract, they might be playing for clubs that go into serious financial difficulty. I'm sure all the I think all of this has been worked out, and as I say, the PFA never move quickly, so I wouldn't be surprised it's taken this long for something to materialise.
Just personally for you, Gregor, have the PFA helped you in any way? Not in your professional experience when you were playing?
Yes, I played for Rotherham United. I forget the year this was, but the club went into administration, and the club asked us to defer a significant percentage of wages, and the PFA came in and negotiated on our behalf, And I think actually they essentially covered they made up the difference so that weren't out of pocket. They basically gave a loan to Rotherham United. Obviously, there's no possibility of them doing this on such a large scale now, but they've done this on numerous occasions, and they also almost entirely funded my journalism degree. So, you know, the PFA has a lot of strength to it. It's just the wheels move so slowly, and they have one man at the helm who is basically his personal fiefdom, and it has been for almost 40 years. You know, if it's brought into the sort of into the 21st century and there's a new leader at the helm, then the PFA can be a real power for good in football.
Sounds as though you've had some really good experiences then of the PFA. Jonathan, just lastly on this subject, I mean, I'm finding this all very bizarre that we're still waiting for that first Premier League club to announce that their players have decided to take the lead themselves and pick up a pay cut, let's say. I know some of the management staff at Bournemouth, as they have at Brighton, have announced that they will take significant pay cuts. But we've seen in the Championship Leeds and both Birmingham announcing that they're going to take wage deferrals. I was hearing that even my club, Brentford, are in discussions about taking pay cuts, and they actually would be the first club to actually take a pay cut, not a wage deferral, which is obviously slightly different. Does it not surprise you that actually the Premier League, the top league in this country, earning the vast amounts of money that it does, is not taking a lead in this when it comes to the players?
It does a bit. I mean, when Juventus and when Barcelona took their action, I thought that maybe one of the big clubs here would follow. Maybe that will happen in the next couple of days. I think Gregor's point about the PFN, you know, it does seem to be a slow-moving organisation, so that might be one of the issues why we haven't got here sooner. But outside of that, I would have liked to have seen a group of players at a club somewhere get together and take some kind of decision, some kind of gesture together. I suppose it's part of where we are with football. There's a lot of agents are having their input, and I do find that in general, players compare themselves to what's happening elsewhere. So if other clubs or colleagues or friends aren't doing it, then they'll think, well, why should we be the first? I'd expect that once one does, then others will follow. But it is a bit disappointing that nobody in the Premier League has got together and taken over on this. And if players did take a deferral or even a cut, you know, it'd be nice for them to help players lower down. And everyone thinks about the 70 grand a week average in Premier League. The sort of players at the, you know, National League, League 2, League 1 level that will really be struggling because of this. Not just because of the low salaries they've got, but a lot of them are on incentivized contracts. Goal bonuses, appearance bonuses become very important at that level, and of course there's none of that. So I'd like to see players doing something to help their own as well. And I know that's what the union's there for, but it doesn't seem to always move quickly in aspect. And it'd be nice for maybe players to just unilaterally decide to do that and make the gesture.
Yeah, it's a situation we will continue to monitor here at The Times, of course.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, it's time for a quiz now. Bill Edgar for The Times Online this week has been testing our knowledge of footballers' real first name. For example, Tammy Abraham's real first name isn't Tammy. It is, of course, Gregor, do you know?
No.
Don't worry. I won't ask you to guess, but it's Kevin, if you didn't know. Okay. Likewise, Harry Maguire isn't Harry. Jonathan, do you know his first name?
Evan.
He's a Jacob. He's called Jacob. If, yeah, yeah, you wouldn't have thought it, would you? Yeah, he's Jacob. but for some reason goes by the name of Harry. So we're going to play a little game of Who Am I today? I'm going to ask Gregor and Jonathan to identify footballers from a list of their ex-teammates. So, for example, if I gave you this one, and this is just an example. I played with Des Walker, Wes Morgan, and played under Chris Wilder. Now, of course, some of you might be struggling, but if I gave you a clue of he likes a press-up, we'd all know it's Gregor Robertson. There we go. All right? All right. So we know what we're doing, don't we? So, Gregor, I'm going to come to you first. Your question is, I played with David Beckham, the Brazilian Ronaldo, Dimitar Berbatov, and Yossi Benayoun. Who could that be?
God. Beckham, Brazilian Ronaldo.
It's tough.
I mean, I'm
any
stumped.
Ideas? Would you like a clue?
Go on then.
I'll give you a clue then. I played with Beckham and Ronaldo, but never played for Real Madrid. Does that help?
Okay. No.
I'll give you another clue. I played with Berbatov at Tottenham and Benayoun at Liverpool. No? Nothing?
You said the Brazilian Ronaldo, right?
I did. How about I tell you that this player was a striker? I know, but it's tough. To be fair, it's tough. It is tough. How about I say he is his country's leading goal scorer? And they always go on about never replacing him.
Who does? This country?
This country, yeah. Jonathan, do you have any ideas?
Think so.
I was going to say Michael Owen. No,
not Michael Owen. Go on, Jonathan. Who do you think it is?
Is it Robbie Keane?
It is Robbie Keane.
Oh,
hey.
Oh, very good. Yeah, of course, Robbie Keane played with Beck's LA Galaxy, Brazilian Ronaldo at Inter Milan, Berbatov at Spurs, and obviously Yossi Benayoun at Liverpool. Okay, Jonathan, here's your question. I played with Sergio Aguero, David Silva, Frank Lampard, Nigel de Jong, and Martin Petrov. Yeah,
the answer to these is usually Marcus Bent, but it's not on this occasion, is it?
It should be. He should have done. So I'll just quickly remind you the players. It's Sergio Aguero, David Silva, Frank Lampard, Nigel de Jong, and Martin Petrov. He played in the Premier League for two clubs, but never for Manchester City.
Oh, I was going to say Patrick Vieira, but it's obviously not.
I suppose, Gregor, you're just out, are you already? You're not even trying.
I'm thinking, but that doesn't mean I'll get it.
Okay. Okay. Well, I can tell you, like Robbie Keane, this footballer was a striker, or is a striker.
Is there a Chelsea connection somewhere?
Well, there may well be a Chelsea connection, yes. What I can tell you as well is, unlike Robbie Keane, this player has won the World Cup.
Oh, wow. I was about to say Nicolas Anelka, and of course he missed it. So,
How about, I'll tell you there's two clubs in England were Liverpool and Chelsea.
Torres?
That's right. Torres. Yeah, it was Gregor. Why did we?
Open goal, that one, in the end.
I know it was. It was a bit easy at the end. But just to tell everyone, Fernando Torres played with Sergio Aguero at Atletico, as he did with David Silva and Martin Petrov. Obviously, Frank Lampard was at Chelsea. Nigel de Jong at AC Milan is who he played with. So that was pretty good. Gregor, you might have to brush up on your players.
Yeah, I'm going to have to start studying Bill's quizzes, I think.
I think so. Well done, Jonathan. 2-0. That's good.
Oh, wow.
We like that.
I'm so bad at quizzes. Gregor must be really
good.
Says a lot about me.
Sorry, Gregor. I never win these. Never.
Oh, do you know what? Let's move on then. And we've got some exciting news for football fans on Saturday night because Match of the Day is back. Sadly, there's still no action to review, but instead Alan Shearer will be centre stage on Match of the Day as he selects three classic Premier League clashes to rewatch and review. So we're going to have our own mini version of Match of the Day here on the podcast in a moment. But first, do we think Shearer's just pick three games where he scored a lot of goals, Gregor?
I'm sure he'll slip at least one in where he's where he said he scored either an absolute screamer or, you know, a hat trick or something. But he can't be too self-absorbed when he's doing this, surely.
Well, you'd like to think he's impartial, but you never know. Okay, so I've asked you both to come up with three Premier League games that you'd like to go back and rewatch if you could. So, Jonathan, let's start with your three.
Oh, it's a really good exercise, actually, because it is a great nostalgia thing. I mean, there's a few that really come to mind. There's one that, you know, Liverpool 4-3 against Newcastle, I think, always comes in the classic games lists. Tottenham 3, Man United 5, I think, when Spurs were 3-1 up. But I wouldn't any of those games. Similarly, City 3-2 to QPR. So I've gone for three games where I actually reported on. I think that's probably the best way for me to do it. So I've gone for Liverpool 5, Arsenal 1 in 2014. Newcastle 4, Arsenal 4 in 2011. Newcastle having been 4-0 down. And Leicester 2, West Ham 2 in 2016. More for the drama than for the classic football involved. But I think those three games, in terms of being there, are just ones that I think stay with me, like the kind of the tension and the feeling of being there for forever, really.
Curious to know then, tell us a bit more about the Liverpool-Arsenal game then.
I mean, that for those that might not remember, that was we're talking 2014. Brendan Rodgers, Liverpool, at the start of that incredible surge they had, it almost took them to the title. And I was at that game, it was early February. Liverpool were actually 8 points behind Arsenal at that time. Arsenal were the league leaders. It's easy to forget that you know, you sort of think of Liverpool almost winning the title, so they must have been the better side. They were fourth, they were nowhere at that time. And the first 20 minutes of that game were just almost like nothing I've seen. Liverpool were 4-0 up after 19 minutes. They could have scored 6 or 7. Luis Suarez hit the post with this just unbelievable volley that would have probably gone down as top three Premier League goals of all time. And it was just the way this young Liverpool side with Suarez, Sturridge, Sterling, with Coutinho pulling the strings, just absolutely ripped Arsenal apart time and time again. Were playing without any kind of thought in their heads other than let's score the next one. Real pure attacking football. And it was a moment, I think, that changed everything. Arsenal were never the same again. I think that hastened the end of the Wenger era. And it propelled people like Suarez and Coutinho to a completely different level, and Sturridge and Sterling. And Jordan Henderson was incredible that day. And it was just that feeling of, I guess it must be like a sensational heavyweight boxing fight when you just see a round where one fighter just obliterates the other, and it's sort of visceral and incredible. It was a lunchtime kickoff as well, and there's something about the fact that those lunchtime kickoffs, you're always a bit sleepy at the beginning. It always feels like you've just rolled out of bed, and that first 20 minutes was just the ultimate kind of wake up at the start of a game. ended up being 5-1, but so many sort of bits of that match sort of stick in the mind. Unforgettable.
So of the three that you've chosen, Jonathan, is there one that particularly stands out?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, Newcastle 4, Arsenal 4 is incredible. I think it's the only time a club's ever come back from 4-0 down. And the thing about that one was, you know, Newcastle are 4-0 down, not just at half-time, but with 22 minutes to go, and Arsenal just had one of their very Arsenal implosions. That was unforgettable, but the one I would actually pick above all else would be Leicester 2, West Ham 2. Four games to go in the title season. I think we all waited for that moment Leicester were going to slip up. Miracle can't happen. And with four games left, they're still in charge of the title race. But that game against West Ham was the moment where I think they stared the cliff edge and didn't topple over. 3 minutes to go, 2-1 down. Vardy's going to be suspended for the run-in, the last couple of games against Chelsea and Manchester United. West Ham are going to win the match. And there was a feeling in the stadium that this is it, the miracle's over. They're going to topple over the brink. And then the twist in the tail, which I think is what really makes a game unforgettable, where in stoppage time, Leicester just went upfield last time. Schlupp was barely touched by Andy Carroll. John Moss evened things up. by giving a penalty at Leonardo, who I scored in the final moments. And the emotion in the stadium, the kind of light switching back on, there were people in tears, was just incredible. And so much about that game was, or so much about the season, I suppose, is unforgettable. But that game almost had all the drama rolled in one. As an occasion, that's just burned in my mind and always will be.
I can understand that. Come on then, Gregor, let's hear your top three.
Well, I think there have to be games that you kind of, obviously I wouldn't have been reporting at them, not having been doing this job for as long. But you have to have watched them, I think. And I was determined, actually, like Johnny, to get a Leicester game, and that was the most thrilling season I can ever remember. And the Man City, I think the game against Man City when they won 3-1 and I think Mahrez broke away and scored. That was another game where you kind of remembered and you thought, crikey, they might do this here. And the Liverpool 4-3 game, I was 12. I don't think I even had Sky, so I can't. They're not in them, but they were very close. So I think the first one has to be Arsenal 4-4. Arsenal against Spurs 4-4 in 2008. Bentley, remember David Bentley? He scored an absolutely outrageous volley. He kind of teed it up for himself and volleyed it from about 40 yards. And then thereafter, it kind of looked like Arsenal were going to run away with it. And I think Darren Bent scored after Almunia fumbled. Then Jermaine Genus scored a cracker with his left foot from outside the box off the post. And then right at the death, Luka Modric, another volley off the post. And it kind of was like time stood still when it fell, came back towards Aaron Lennon. And he finished it home to get to 4-4 and kind of right at the death and ran off doing a windmill celebration, that kind of pure glee. You can't control yourself. So I thought that was a classic. And I remember watching it. You have to remember where you were and stuff. So I remember watching that game. And I think some of the battles between Manchester United and Arsenal, I've gone for the one when Roy Keane and Patrick Vieira kind of squared up in the tunnel, Keane defending Gary Neville. I think it was 4-2 to Manchester United, the game. But that era, you know, Manchester United had Roy Keane, Paul Scholes, Ryan Giggs, Ronaldo, Rooney. Arsenal had Ljungberg, Pires, Vieira, Henri, Bergkamp. I think that was the pinnacle of the Premier League era, really, essentially. And I think in that game, Silvestre got sent off with 20 minutes to go and Manchester United were 3-2 up. And they were kind of hanging on for dear life. And then John O'Shea scored the most un-John O'Shea goal ever. He lobbed Almunia with his left foot to kind of seal it right at the death. So that was it. And I know the last one's obvious, but it has to be the Manchester City against QPR Aguero moment. It was, we'll never see that again. And I think I was watching, I just went back and watched that kind of final goal beforehand, before we came on, and just the little moments like Balotelli kind of holding the ball up and falling to the floor and scrambling across the ground to hook the ball into the path of Aguero. Aguero taking a touch where most people would panic and just try and hit the target. He took a touch beyond the kind of flailing defender, and then the coolness personified under pressure to hammer it in at the near post. And the scenes, yeah, that's the best moment in Premier League history. So I think that game has to be number one.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would echo that as well, Gregor. The thing is, we asked on Twitter if there was one game that could be in your top three, what would that be? And plenty have sent in their suggestions. So thank you for those that have done that. Ron is a Stoke fan. Predictably, he's gone for a Stoke game. Stoke 6, Liverpool 1. Need I say any more, says Ron. Matthew Beige says Middlesbrough 8, Manchester City 1, please. That's what he would like to see again. Clive Price and Daniel Rees both went for West Brom 5, Manchester United 5 in Sir Alex Ferguson's last game. Also, Lorenzo has mentioned the Arsenal-Reading match where Reading were 4-0 up, practically out of sight. And then Arsenal came back into the game, went on to win it 7-5. Also, notable mention for Liverpool against Newcastle in 96 with Collymore closing in. And Martin Hardy has written a piece for the Times today on that classic 4-3 match if you would like to relive it. It's been nice to have that little trip down memory lane. It's all given us a bit of nostalgia, and I think we'll all be looking forward to the return of football when that will be. But that is it for now. Many thanks to Gregor and to Jonathan as well. You may find yourself with some time on your hands in the coming weeks, so do remember you can subscribe to the Times and the Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. And remember, we asked Jonathan at the start of this pod about Wayne Rooney. Well, this Sunday, Rooney Revisits is the series that starts in the Sunday Times, so check that one out. It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search the Times subscription for more information. And we will be back on Monday for the Game Podcast. Have a good weekend. Most importantly, stay safe.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.